The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by Dr. Brett Weinstein, who is an evolutionary biologist and host of the Dark Horse podcast. And Brett, you are somebody I could talk to a lot of things about. You seem to cover a lot of subjects. But I thought I'd start by asking you about the Darien Gap, which is an area of Panama that has become a focal point for America's migrant crisis, because it seems a lot of people are getting through there, even though it appears to be impenetrable in many parts. For our listeners who don't know, can you just start with your trip to the Darien Gap, why you went there and what's going on?
Well, sure. Maybe I should just tell you what the Darien Gap is.
Yeah.
There is a highway, the Pan-American Highway, that runs from Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, all the way to the southern tip of South America. It is unbroken, but for a 60-mile stretch at the border between Panama and Colombia. That is the so-called Darien Gap. The Darien Gap is a wilderness area. As you say, I think we can't call it impenetrable because obviously people are crossing it with increasing regularity, but it is extremely perilous. It is not a hospitable piece of jungle. And many of the migrants who are coming from South America, most of them headed towards the United States, they are entering this wilderness woefully unprepared. Many are dying. Others are suffering substantial injuries. And I went to see what could possibly be going on there because what I was hearing wasn't making any sense.
Yes. And the makeup of these people is perhaps surprising to people who haven't been following the migrant crisis in America. It's not Hispanics. There are Hispanics who are migrating, but it tends to be a similar immigrant crisis to what you see in other parts of the world, which is a sort of mix of people from all over North Africa through Eurasia and so on, is it not?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not Hispanics. I think there is a major component, especially refugees from Venezuela and also a substantial number from Haiti. People are coming from all over. But yes, the most surprising thing is the number of people who are coming from China, coming from the Middle East and other parts of North Africa. So it's an odd migration in the sense that people who have no reason to be starting in South America seem to be arriving in Quito, Ecuador, presumably because Ecuador does not have a visa requirement. So people who are intending to migrate to the U.S. are able to make landfall in Ecuador and then move by various methods to the southern portion of the Darien Gap, where they mostly transit on foot. But then there is also the conspicuous fact that there is a large contingent of Chinese migrants who seem to be bypassing the most perilous aspects of the Darien Gap by boat and joining this larger migration in southern Panama, where they move rather directly to the United States.
You saw these Chinese migrants yourself. Did you talk to them and find out where they were actually coming from, why they're there, and so on?
We certainly tried to talk to them. And I'm not certain how effective I've been at conveying it, is how distinct the interaction with the Chinese migrants is compared to migrants from everywhere else. We had many conversations with people from all over the world, and most were forthcoming about what they were doing, which in some ways was surprising to me because all of the migrants who were willing to speak with us spoke of fleeing economic hardship. which is not a justification for gaining asylum in the United States. They would have to be fleeing political persecution, which none mentioned. When one attempts to talk to the Chinese migrants, there is a decided reluctance to convey any useful information. There is obvious deception, and it left me with the impression that there are, in fact, two patterns in Darien. One is an economic migration that is uncontrolled and global in nature, and a Chinese migration, which it's hard to prove, but certainly one has to entertain the possibility, in light of the tensions between China and the United States, that this is not a friendly migration, that these people have left China with the certainly the knowledge of the Chinese Communist Party and quite possibly the blessing of the Chinese government, and that their migration north is being facilitated for reasons that have never been discussed with any of the Central American countries that they are passing through or with the American public.
Would you surmise then that there is an element to which, I mean, I went to Ukraine at the beginning of the war there, and I remember on the Polish border, there was an enormous number of migrants who just suddenly appeared. And what people said there was that they were sent as a kind of a disrupting factor. They were sent from Belarus to sort of cause chaos among the West. Are you suggesting then that there may be an element in which foreign powers are using, I think, migrants as a kind of weapon of war or covert warfare?
I think we would be painfully naive to imagine that our adversaries abroad haven't noticed the open southern U.S. border and contemplated in what way they might exploit it to their advantage and our disadvantage. Mm. I can't imagine why in an environment in which people certainly build weapons in anticipation of future conflicts, that this much simpler approach would not be utilized. So I worry about that. Now, of course, I have no evidence that there is a plan being deployed that these people are hostile, but I will say the prediction of the hypothesis that the Chinese in particular might be exploiting our open southern border for military or quasi-military purposes, the prediction of that is that upon meeting the migrants, that they would not function the way the other migrants do, that they would not. Here's what threw me. If I was a Chinese person fleeing oppression in China, headed to the United States, a land of opportunity, I would be fascinated by Americans that I met early in that journey. I would be interested in talking to them. Now, maybe I would be afraid of repercussions. I could imagine that they would be unwilling to talk, but one would get a sense from such people that they were interested in these representatives of their new homeland. That was not the impression they left at all. The impression was that they looked down upon us. There was resentment. And I cannot explain why people migrating to a country such as ours would have that sense unless they had an ulterior motive.
And did they look destitute? I mean, often if you, anyone who's seen illegal migrants, you can just tell that they are desperate people very quickly. Did you get that impression from the Chinese migrants as much as you did from other migrants?
I don't want to draw this more cleanly than it was in reality. Most of the Chinese migrants that we encountered were housed in a transit camp that was unlike any other grouping that we saw. So the Chinese migrants were concentrated, and the migrants in that transit camp called San Vicente, which is a camp that Secretary Mayorkas publicly visited prior to its substantial expansion, the Chinese in that camp did not appear destitute at all. And information that has come from those who have done reconnaissance on the question suggests that they had, as I said earlier, bypassed much of the peril of the Darien Gap by traveling by boat. Mm. Now, there were a smaller number of Chinese migrants in the other camps that we visited. They were also reluctant to speak to us, but their condition was in keeping with the majority of the migrants from South America, from Africa, from elsewhere in Asia. So it's not 100%, but there was a concentrated group of Chinese migrants that did not appear desperate, were decidedly unfriendly, and were housed by the Panamanians in isolation from the main migration for reasons that are unclear.
You talked about them not having the, or possibly, you know, having the blessing of China to be there. But if they are, as you suggest, kind of well-funded and so on, are you suggesting they are sort of agents rather than just sort of victims of circumstance?
Well, I want you to put yourself in my shoes for a second. I went to see a migration that I had heard about but was reluctant to talk about until I had seen it because I was concerned something about the story couldn't possibly be as it was represented. It turned out that not only was the story as represented, but it was a good bit more alarming than the reports I had gotten had led me to understand. I have no information on what the actual origin story of the Chinese migrants is. I'm just like everybody else looking at this, trying to understand why their facial expressions, their attitudes, their appearance is what it is, and I don't know. But my hypothesis would be that they were more coordinated than would make sense as a group of people fleeing oppressive circumstances, that there was a hierarchy in the camp that was detectable but invisible. In other words, there were certain individuals who moved around the camp and appeared to keep track of us as we attempted to have conversations. And all of it did suggest an effort with a purpose in which there was some kind of rank that was not worn on the clothing of the people in question.
And did you talk to the Panamanians about the Chinese presence?
We tried to talk to the Panamanians about the Chinese presence. The Panamanians are in a very different position. They were also reluctant to speak, in part because their jobs require them not to. So the CENAFRONT is the Panamanian border authority, and it is charged with keeping the migration orderly. Now, there is also an inobvious kind of peril in the sense that the Panamanians have a huge number of people moving through Panama. As long as those people keep going, the burden on the Panamanian economy is manageable.
Mm.
But it is definitely in the interest of Panamanians and the Panamanian government to facilitate the migration so they don't end up stuck with desperate people that they don't have an ability to take care of. So you can imagine that the Panamanian government may or may not like this migration, but that irrespective of their private sense of the wisdom of it, in light of the fact that people are coming through Panama, that their incentive is to make it orderly and keep those people moving as quickly as possible northward. So that explains why the CENAFRONT, many of whom appear not to be happy about the migration, are also reluctant to talk about it. They probably can't. That said, there is a clear contingent among the CENAFRONT that views the migration in very negative terms and specifically views the transit through the Darien as unwise and undesirable. Panamanians have a complex relation with the Darien Gap. It functions like a border wall, and watching it breached is not something most Panamanians would look positively on. So all of those things are in play. Yes, we attempted to talk to the Panamanians. Most Panamanians who do not live in Darien are largely unaware of what is taking place in that province. Those who are living close enough to it to see it have complex feelings about it. And those who are professionally employed managing it are reluctant to talk because they're not allowed to.
And can you give us a sense of the the migrants who are having to travel through this, to make this dangerous journey through the gap, I mean, how long does it take? Do they walk through it? Is it, I mean, how does the actual journey happen? And where do they come from originally? Do they land somewhere by plane nearby?
Those who are not coming from South America land in Ecuador because of the lack of a visa requirement. They move by various means to the end of the road in South America, in Colombia. And they largely hire what we would call coyotes, what I understand is being called snakeheads in South America. They hire them to shepherd them through the Darien. What happens afterwards is a humanitarian disaster. Most of these people are robbed on the way, which leaves them in a desperate situation when they arrive on the other side in Panama. They have to come up with money in order to facilitate their travel by bus into Costa Rica. Women are routinely raped. And in fact, the international organizations that are facilitating this migration have been handing out kits to mitigate the consequences of those rapes that they know full well are taking place. People are dying in the jungle because it's very hard to appreciate how difficult a jungle like this is to cross. People have the wrong footwear. They end up sleeping in their shoes and they get trench foot. The soils and the steepness of the terrain mean that people are sliding down these banks that have been made treacherous by all of the people trekking ahead of them. It's very easy to sprain or break a limb. Parents are dying in the jungle. Children are leaving orphaned and vice versa. It's a terrible tragedy that is taking place. And one of the things that my son traveled with me to Darien to help document this, one of the things that we were struck by was the irresponsibility of the international community in facilitating and encouraging a migration across the Darien. It simply could not possibly end well. And the fact that huge numbers of people are dying because these NGOs are representing the trek as more doable than it actually is, it's just simply a tragedy in its own right.
You mentioned international agencies and NGOs there. Which ones in particular are we talking about?
Well, the primary one is the IOM, which is part of the UN, the International Organization of Migration. But there's also HIAS. And you can see the pride that these international organizations take in facilitating this migration is visible in the signage that they have put, for example, in the migrant camps, signage that gives people a sense of where they are, where they're going to head next. It's a very strange migration in the sense that there's so much infrastructure. Now, when we talked to some of the locals who are, I mentioned the Chinese camp San Vicente, which is uniquely housed away from Panamanians. There's no settlement of Panamanians in the place where San Vicente is. But the other camps are embedded in outposts of civilization that exist in Darien, little towns. And the townspeople are caught in the very bind I mentioned to you earlier, which is they're stuck with a migration that they don't like. But it is far better that the migrants have proper toilets and clean drinking water than that they're left to fend for themselves. So these Panamanians are facilitating the migration themselves because it's a better option than standing back and letting it unfold as it otherwise would.
And the NGO workers who are there, presumably they are not vile people. They think they're doing good.
Again, I don't want to draw the picture more cleanly than is warranted. I would imagine that 99% of them are exactly as you describe, but I can't say that there's not some tiny number that is operating based on some understanding of the world that they have not shared with us. But no, most of the NGO workers certainly imagine that they are on the right side of history and that they are doing right by the migrants. But the oddest feature of that little microcosm is If you look, for example, on the web pages of the International Organization of Migration, you will find that they assert that migration is simply a good thing. It's a kind of abstract academic notion that is completely inconsistent with what one sees when one looks at this migration of injured people who've been imperiled, raped in the jungle, right? Migration is not simply a good thing. What's more, even if migration was simply a good thing from the point of view of the international picture, there are questions of national sovereignty. Presumably, nations have a right to govern the borders that allow them to manage their own economic predicament in a reasonable way. So even if the international community thinks migration is a good thing, Americans, for example, have a right to say, yes, but it's going to make the lives of Americans worse. We have to solve the international problem in some other way. You can't just simply offload global problems onto any nation. It's not a fair way of dealing with that predicament. So the fact that you can read all these things on their webpages and you can discover that some folks have decided migration is simply a good thing and overridden, in a de facto sense, our national sovereignty is quite conspicuous.
And that 1% you talk about who see what's going on in the world in a different way to perhaps we do, what are you suggesting there? What are you implying? That they are looking to destabilize America through mass migration? That they are anti-Western, anti-American, and operating on behalf of China and Russia? I mean, it's, I'm not disputing what you're saying. I'm just, I don't quite grasp what they would be trying to do.
Well, I spent enough time in the academy to know that there are some folks who have some rather radical notions about the way human affairs should be managed. So it may be that there are folks who view the well-being of the United States as hostile to the globe. There may be those who view a redistribution of resources globally from those with more to those with less as so obviously a good thing that they're absolutely willing to override quaint notions like national sovereignty. I don't know what they're thinking. Frankly, I don't know that they exist. It's possible everybody in the NGO world is well-intentioned, or that the things I've just described qualify as being well-intentioned in their own minds. But as an American, I find it absolutely alarming that without a discussion or a vote or representation of any apparent kind, somebody has decided to alter the way my nation functions because of what was apparently a private discussion to which we were not invited.
Sorry, what's the private discussion there? I didn't quite follow it.
Somebody decided migration's a good thing, and they didn't apparently air both sides of the puzzle. And so yes, migration is happening because some people think it's a good idea. And the question is, where do the people who disagree have the opportunity to lodge their position? I think the discussion simply didn't happen, which means that the discussion in which people decided that migration was simply a good thing was a private one.
Well, let's look at the political side of it. The Department of Homeland Security, ICE, there are government agencies that are meant to deal with this problem. They don't seem to be. There's a massive illegal immigration crisis at the southern border. A lot of people on the right suggest that the Biden administration is quite willing to allow a massive immigration crisis because it suits it politically. I don't quite see how that works because, as you can see in the polls, Biden is struggling as a result.
Well, I don't think these puzzle pieces are as simple as we once imagined and maybe that they once were. It's clear that Secretary Mayorkas is facilitating this migration. It's clear that the Biden administration is trying to manage the embarrassment that comes from it. I've heard numerous hypotheses about why the Biden administration might view the migration positively, although it portrays itself as simply helpless to do anything about it. But I have become skeptical that I even know what the Biden administration is. The Biden administration is clearly being headed by a decrepit figurehead, which means that the governance of my nation is also extra constitutional. Something is governing my country that does not match anything described in our founding documents, and that alarmingly is not accountable. If we don't know who is actually in charge, we can't call them in front of Congress and ask them questions. So what is that? And again, I don't believe me, I say this with the greatest reluctance. I do not wish to do this in an irresponsible way. But much as our southern border suggests a vulnerability that I feel certain our detractors abroad will have noticed, the corruption of our political system is exactly the same. Surely our enemies have discovered that our politicians are for sale, and to the extent that they wish to accomplish something, it would be cheaper and safer to accomplish it by corrupting our political class than it would be to fight us on a battlefield. So I don't know why the Biden administration is doing what it's doing. I don't know that it has been captured by foreign adversaries, but I'd be foolish not to wonder, given that it is obviously behaving in a way that is bad for the citizenry.
And a lot of Americans increasingly think the way that you do. They probably haven't been to the Darien Gap. Well, they certainly haven't. Most people haven't. But they are called by the international media, by the BBC and so on, they're called conspiracy theorists. And I think you would probably be called a conspiracy theorist for what you've just said. How do you respond to that?
Unfortunately, I think adults have to recognize that humans conspire. They collude. They do so when the advantage of colluding exceeds the costs and risks of being exposed. At the moment, we don't have a functional press corps in the U.S. We have once great newspapers that report the official narrative and only report the actual story when public awareness of the story is so great that they are embarrassed into doing so. Mm. I didn't create that situation. I don't think it is my responsibility not to notice that these things are at odds with what we were led to understand our system was made of. Now, that said, I am a scientist. I am, in fact, an evolutionary theorist. I know how theory is done. When I advance an idea, I do so in the form of a hypothesis. That means I'm not telling you that I believe this idea is true. What I'm telling you is that I believe this is a plausible explanation for a pattern that we have seen. Mm. And from hypotheses flow predictions that allow us to test them. So I don't know what a conspiracy theorist is. I've certainly met people who are completely irresponsible, see conspiracies everywhere, never entertain other kinds of possibilities. I am no such person. But do I believe that conspiracies happen? Of course I do. History tells us they happen. Numerous conspiracies have been revealed to be true. So any rational adult has to entertain the possibility, in fact, the certainty that they are playing some role in our current historical chapter. And all I would say is it is incumbent on us to wield the tools of analysis carefully so that we do not find ourselves embracing hypotheses for which there is no evidence, but we entertain hypotheses that explain otherwise mysterious patterns, and that we look at all of the potential hypotheses that might explain them. And I think if people will go back through this interview, they will hear that that's what I've been doing. I'm telling you where I don't know that something is true, but that there is a potential explanation I can see that would account for the pattern that is evident.
And has your sense that government, that leadership, that Americans' leadership, global leadership arguably, are colluding against the interests of American people, of common people everywhere. Has that increased dramatically as a result of the COVID pandemic? Is it because of what happened then that you have become more alert or suspicious of what's going on in the world?
Well, I think that's a conclusion people often reach because they became aware of me during the so-called pandemic. Mm. But it's actually not a good match for my history. I've been very concerned about political corruption and perverse incentives for decades. It is true that the degree to which corruption turned our pandemic response on its head awakened me to the level of that corruption at a new height. But no, all it did was alert me to how ingrained, how enmeshed these corrupt elements have become in our system. It did not cause me to think that this process was new, just that it was further along than I understood.
And have you become, I won't say sinophobic, but have you become far more suspicious of China in the last 5 years than you were?
Well, I don't believe in China. I believe that there is the Chinese Communist Party,
of course,
has factions within it, that it is not in complete agreement with itself about which direction to move things. But I believe that the Chinese people are victims of this oppressive force. So you might say I'm sinophilic in the sense that I have tremendous compassion for the population of the world's largest nation that are suffering under a kind of tyranny that I do not wish them or my own country to suffer under. But am I suspicious of the Chinese Communist Party, at least to the extent that I can see what it appears to be doing and what it appears to desire? Yes, I'm on high alert, as I think any reasonable person would be.
Obviously, a news story this week has been about the TikTok ban. Well, it's not a ban, it's a force of TikTok to be divestiture to a US entity. The House of Representatives voted that through. Is that something you're particularly concerned about? Is the power of China to effectively brainwash large chunks of the young population through TikTok, through short-form video content?
I think it's a very complex issue in the following sense. Yes, I'm absolutely concerned at the highest level about brainwashing through social media platforms, both orchestrated and organic. The idea that children brainwash each other through these mechanisms is also something to be truly concerned about. I don't think it's limited to TikTok. I don't frankly know the degree to which fear of TikTok has been amped up and it is misplaced. But I think our social media environment is a danger. It has led, at the very least, to the spread of contagious, toxic ideas like men can become women and that children who express any sort of ambivalence about the bodies that they were born into are in need of surgery and other medical interventions. So yes, I'm very concerned about this. However, I am also very concerned that my government would utilize the natural alarm that people feel about things like TikTok to engineer a control structure that they clearly desire. We can see the attempts to erect such a control structure in the Pandemic Preparedness Treaty and international health regulations moving towards a vote in May at the World Health Organization and in numerous initiatives domestically. There, something wishes to control what can be said and what people may choose to listen to. And I worry that the TikTok ban is a wolf in sheep's clothing that appears to be an effort to protect Americans, and it may be the opposite.
Well, anything that Nancy Pelosi seems to be behind, I can see why you might think that. I mean, you've used the word something there a few times. What is your best guess at what that something is?
Well, first of all, people who think carefully often have a nervousness about the idea when anybody talks about a they or a something, it sounds like that is irresponsible. I know from studying complex systems that that's not true, that it is perfectly rational when you detect the influence of something to use a placeholder. You know, if I see a particular kind of damage to a particular kind of leaf in a tropical forest, but I haven't seen the animal that does it, it is perfectly rational for me to say there appears to be an animal that is doing this kind of damage, and I can advance hypotheses as to what it might be and what the nature of the damage is. Those are ideas to be tested. And likewise, I think we can see a clear pattern where censorship and coercion has been used to advance narratives long after it was absolutely apparent that they were false. I don't know what entity wishes us to believe false things or why, but I can say with a good degree of confidence that there is at least one something playing that role.
Hmm.
Is it rent-seeking elites who are making a profit because informational advantages can be utilized to effectively print money? That's a possibility. I would regard that as the least terrible explanation for the pattern in question, that somebody is simply profiting due to public ignorance and therefore is doing their best to make sure we remain in the dark. It could be worse. It could be an adversary that wishes us to be misinformed so that we won't see something coming. I don't know. But I do know that a rational discussion would involve putting all of those hypotheses on the table and saying, as the pattern develops going forward, which of these hypotheses best explains it?
Mm. And perhaps as a rational scientist, you won't want to answer this question, but do you ever consider there's a spiritual dimension to it, that we are dealing with evil or something like that?
Well, I mean, interesting that you should ask. As an evolutionary biologist, I have long argued that evil is not something we need to be very concerned about. And the reason that I say that is because it's not a good strategy. Evil, that is, doing harm for its own sake, tends to be a self-extinguishing strategy, whereas amorality, profiting irrespective of the harm to others, is a very good strategy. So that's the thing we need to be concerned about. But that said, I find myself looking at many of the patterns in the present and finding that amorality, while it may technically be the correct explanation, is insufficient to capture the horror. So I do find myself speaking about evil more frequently than ever before because, for example, doctors encouraging healthy young people to sterilize themselves, to cut off perfectly functional body parts as the result of a utopian presentation of what is medically possible, amorality doesn't quite cut it. This is a profession that takes an oath to do no harm that is involved in mutilating healthy young people with long lives ahead of them. So I think that is why we have a term like evil, and it is a moment at which we need to think how, without being hyperbolic, to carefully invoke it where it applies.
Well, on that terrifying note, we shall end it there. But Dr. Brett Weinstein, thank you very much for coming on to the Americano podcast. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's it for that episode of the Americano podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I'd like to thank our brilliant Spectator production team, Natasha Feroz, my producer, Oscar Edmondson, who's sitting opposite me. And I would like to ask any listeners who have ideas as to who they think I should get on the podcast. We're going to be doing two a week, so we have to come up with plenty of ideas this year. And often you have much better ideas than I do. So please do get in touch if you have an idea of a guest that you think we should try and get on the show, or a subject that you think we haven't covered that we should be covering. And please email that to podcast@spectator.co.uk, or you can get in touch with me directly on Twitter. I think my handle is FreddieGray31, which is depressingly how old I was when I set up my Twitter account. Okay, please do that. Goodbye.